Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The National Guard is going to be in Ferguson, Missouri tonight with just one thing in mind, says Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson.
Tonight, we will ensure the safety of the citizens of Ferguson, the visitors to Ferguson, and the businesses of Ferguson.
But what happens to a business when the sheriff comes to town? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 18th of August. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It has been, as you know, more than a week now since the fatal police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. Much of the ensuing violence has been confined to a couple of areas in town, but those areas are feeling it. Businesses have been looted and burned. Owners have boarded up windows and doors, and customers are staying away, which means a business doesn't really have to be in the line of fire to get hit. Marketplace's Noel King starts us off today.
The last thing that Corey Nixon Clark needs to worry about right now is looting.
We're standing outside of the back door of your business. What do you see?
That's like a tank truck with police officers in there laying down doing something.
What does the front entrance look like?
A lot worse. There are many, many, many police cars. There's a helicopter in the front, two helicopters in the front, porta potties, police officers, you name it, it's there.
Nixon Clark owns Swish Bar and Grill. He started it with 401k money and his savings after working for Wells Fargo for 10 years. The bar is tucked into one corner of a large suburban mall in the town of Jennings, just up the road from where the Ferguson protests turned violent. About a week ago, he and his wife got a call from the property owner, who told him that the bar's parking lot was being turned into a police command center.
I've seen St. Louis County, I've seen St. Louis City, I've seen state troopers, I've seen some FBI. I think pretty much every department of the police department has been here.
Nixon Clark's sister, Andra Crawford, who's keeping him company in the silent, empty bar tonight, can barely believe the kind of stuff she's seeing.
I got pictures. Look, if you see here, you see the pictures of the tanks and stuff like that. And then this is the parking lot. You can see the helicopter back here if I blow it up for you.
Nobody's been able to tell Nixon Clark why his little business, with its two-for-one happy hour and famous strawberry chicken wings, was chosen, and not, say, Target or the Big Schnucks grocery store or any of the other big chain stores in the same mall. Their parking lots are at least partially accessible.
Those guys are able to open at some point during the day. I'm not able to open at all. So at least they're able to get some type of revenue coming in.
Nixon Clark estimates he's lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 in the past week. He admits there is insurance that would cover this, riot insurance, but he didn't buy it. He thought, really, when was the last time there was a riot in Jennings, Missouri?
Hi, sir. Highway Patrol. Okay, sorry, where are they?
The officers outside Swish don't know why this part of the parking lot was chosen either. Sergeant Al Notham of the Missouri State Highway Patrol says the answer is above his pay grade. But as a solution, he says, maybe people could just park somewhere else and walk over.
I think if I was wanting to go out, I might be a little intimidated by all the police presence here to go into a bar. Some people may not be. Obviously, there's people in there. I can see them in there. But
his sister and his cousin. Oh, they're not paying customers.
Notham says he's sympathetic. He hates to see a small business owner losing money. But the police plan to stay until things get better.
There's not one of us here that want to be here any longer than we need to. We want things to settle down. We want the citizens of Ferguson to know that we're doing the best we can and that we're looking for a good resolution to this whole thing here.
But so far, there has been no resolution. Last night was one of the worst nights in Ferguson so far. The National Guard is being sent in, and Corey Nixon Clark has just found out they're going to be using his parking lot, too. In Ferguson, Missouri, I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Wall Street today somehow seems a long, long way from Ferguson, Missouri. Up arrows at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. What you might fairly call a dollar store war broke out today. Dollar General, the biggest of the dollar store chains, stepped in to break up a proposed union of two fellow dollar stores. Dollar Tree and Family Dollar. And yes, you do, in fact, need a playbill to keep up with the cast of characters here. Dollar Tree made an $8.5 billion bid to buy Family Dollar a couple of weeks ago. Seemed to be a done deal, too, but now Dollar General is in the mix with a $9.7 billion bid and possibly a better case for compatibility, too. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the Dollar Store Report.
You're in love, but you have some commitment issues. So you wait. You hem, you haw, and then...
We're getting married.
Well,
it's a bit like that 90s romantic comedy, My Best Friend's Wedding.
He was in love with me every day for 9 years.
Me? She has known him for, what, 5 seconds?
Evidently, this doesn't just happen to Julia Roberts. It also happens in the business world. In this case, the panicked Julia Roberts is Dollar General. Rumors about it buying Family Dollar have circulated for years.
Dollar General's always been kind of interested, but I think they always thought, oh, we can do it another day, we can do it another day.
Brian Yarbrough is an analyst with Edward Jones. He says Family Dollar and Dollar General are obviously compatible. Both focus on food items and carry lots of brand names, Coke, Pepsi, Tide. Both often charge more than a dollar. But the perfect pair was nearly broken up by newcomer Dollar Tree.
When Dollar Tree made the bid, I think it took Dollar General by surprise. And I think they felt like, this is our last chance. I mean, it's now or never.
Dollar Tree focuses on discretionary items, party supplies, beauty products, things like that. It's strict about the dollar price. Winning Family Dollar's hand is critical for both dollar stores, says analyst Phil Lempert.
A lot of people during the recession really discovered that it was a great place where you could save a lot of money. Now, as the economy's gotten a little bit better, the visits to the dollar channel has actually been reduced.
And competition is ramping up. Walmart is about to open hundreds of mini locations that will compete with dollar stores. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City is hosting a symposium later this week focusing on the ins and outs of the labor market. Among the items likely to be on the agenda is the slow pace of improvement in that market. Yes, the unemployment rate is off its recession-era high of 10% to a more tolerable 6.2% today. But there are some other indicators that are moving much more slowly. Marketplace's Abri Benishore has that story.
To get an idea of how the national economic car is moving, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen looks at what is called her dashboard. It's a bunch of economic statistics. You can imagine them as dials. Some appear to be, if not stuck, then, well, just not moving as quickly as others. One is the number of people doing part-time work because they can't find full-time work. Kyle Hubert knows all about this.
Since April of 2013, I've applied for 476 positions, not one of which has led to an actual offer for full-time work.
In the meantime, he's been doing part-time work as a cybersecurity consultant.
It's a little frustrating. Even with part-time and with unemployment benefits, it's not enough to get by.
People working part-time because of economic reasons are invisible if you just look at the unemployment rate, but they are important because it's not all about quantity when it comes to jobs.
It is one indicator of the quality of the jobs that workers find themselves forced to accept.
Gary Bertless is a labor economist with the Brookings Institution. The level of long-term unemployed people is high, too, and it's pushing people to take jobs they wouldn't normally resort to. Another sticky indicator is wages, says Joe Kalish with Ned Davis Research.
We really haven't seen much of a pickup with wages and compensation.
Wages for median workers haven't moved at all over the recovery. Kalish says, with so many sticky dials, the Fed is unlikely to hit the brakes, as in raise interest rates, before mid-next year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I know we're running out of time for most of you to get away while summer is still upon us, but do yourself and your colleagues and your boss and your company a favor and just do it, will you? 15% of workers in this country, according to some research out this spring, that is one out of every seven workers who are entitled to paid vacation time, didn't use any of it in the past year. Nancy Kane teaches at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, it's good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
I was going to start this interview with a question about what kind of people don't like to take vacations. And then I realized that I myself honestly have a tough time taking vacations. It's a real thing.
It's a real thing. And, you know, it has, I think, a variety of sources or a variety of, you know, gas pumps behind it. One is people are used to being very on and doing things all the time. And work has now, for many, many people, perhaps the majority of U.S. workers, become something that is no longer 9 to 5 and confined to the office or the factory or the sales floor. So work is all over our lives. So when we stop working, it's hard to adjust. That's a big piece because we're used to doing it all the time. I think a second really important piece is that there's survey data that shows that somewhere around 13% of U.S. managers, right, are more likely to promote people who don't take all their vacation days. So there is some basis for believing that appearing to be a good soldier with your nose to the grindstone is good work and career strategy.
Yeah, if it is good work and career strategy, that's great. But it's got to be, A, bad for you, the individual, but also bad for the workplace, because nobody wants to work at a place where everybody's always grinding away and your boss is sending emails at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Absolutely. So the perception of managers and workers, right, that somehow people that never take any vacation are always doing their job are somehow better team members, more productive, you know, kind of better doobies. It turns out that the evidence on all that, the real evidence, not the perception, the real evidence is unambiguous that people who take time off, right, day by day and in week blocks or in, you know, blocks of several days or in longer time periods are, guess what, less stressed, more focused at their job, more engaged, more creative, and more productive.
How did it come to be that we Americans have this weird thing about vacation? Because, I mean, we were joking literally today in the work meeting, in our morning editorial meeting, about the French, and the French are now getting back to work after their August, you know, vacations.
So that's a really good question. And if you look at the data, it's really easy to find. It's really well measured by labor departments in different countries all over the world. Americans, right, take so much less vacation than anyone else. I think the highest of the industrial countries is Austria with 38 days of paid vacation. Yeah. And, you know, in America, there some 1 in 4 workers has zero paid vacation.
Exactly. That's the staggering
thing. Exactly. And what we're talking about is people that have the paid vacation that don't take it.
We were talking before we turned the microphones on about my last vacation. I just took one. When was yours?
You know, I probably haven't taken a vacation in about four years.
That's terrible. I can't even believe that.
That's terrible.
And you're a you're a trained professional.
I'm a trained coach. I'm a trained coach, and
Lord.
I'm a historian. And I do ride my horses, right? I do ride my horses 6 days a week, and I try and reset in a very yoga-like way every single day that I do that.
You got to get away.
Mea culpa, not the same. Got to get away.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Thank you, Nancy.
Always a great pleasure.
I got you, didn't I? I got you on that last one.
You sure did.
We'll see you later. Coming up,
it was hard to appreciate before going into practice how dominant the financial aspects of modern American medicine really are.
First, do no harm, but make a profit too, would you? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 175 points today. 1% closed at 16,838. The NASDAQ put on 43 points, also 1%, 4508. Their highest close in 14, count them, 14 years. The S&P 500 added 16 points, 0.8%, finished at 1971. On Wall Street today, some dollar stores were worth more than others, as we were saying. Dollar General jumped 11%. Family Dollar raised its share price 5%. But Dollar Tree, the loser, if the other two combined, marked down 2.4% today. All sorts of surveys measure confidence these days. Consumer confidence, manufacturers' confidence. A survey of home builders has found them more confident for the second straight month. And their stocks, ooh, plenty confident. Pulte Group added 2.8% today. Toll Brothers up 1.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. On this day in 1913, Clarence Crane trademarked his new invention, the Lifesavers Candy. In 2004, Google's first public offering took place on Wall Street with an opening price of $85 per share. And happy birthday to the 42nd President of the United States, Bill Clinton. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The federal government is by far the biggest spender in this economy. So even something as mundane as per diem payments, what government employees and sometimes contractors are expected to have to pay for their travel expenses, can have outsized impacts. The General Services Administration says per diem rates for hotels will be largely flat in most cities in the coming fiscal year, $83 as a standard rate, far more in the pricier cities. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has the trickle-down effect.
The federal government is trying to keep its travel budget down. It's cutting spending by 30% through 2016. That means no fancy hotels.
We certainly do not include the luxury brands like the Ritz-Carltons or the Four Seasons type, but we also want to be cognizant of our traveler safety, and so we try not to go too budget.
That's Christine Harada with the government's General Services Administration. She says federal lodging per diems vary by city and are determined by market data. Per diems went up in about 270 areas and fell in 50. Ryan Melliker is with the investment bank MLV & Company. He says hotels that get a lot of business from feds will set their overall room rates based on the per diem.
If you think about a hotel right next to, like, you know, a major Air Force base that's generating a lot of their business from government, it's going to have a bigger impact on them than it is somebody else, right?
And Jan Freitag with STR, a hotel research company that provides market data to the federal government, says the federal per diems also have spillover effects at private companies.
And they say, okay, if the U.S. government reimburses this much, we just follow suit, especially if we are a consulting company to the U.S. government.
In other words, Freitag says per diem rates can also have an effect on broader business travel. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Residents of the city of Chicago are going to see their phone bills go up at the end of the month, thanks to some higher fees being collected by their city government. The new revenue is supposed to be used to pay for 911 services, but it's a poorly kept secret that the money is going to be used to fund municipal employees' pensions. If one is politically cynical, the rationale works like this. If government raised the money by increasing property taxes, everybody would notice and then complain. But people are used to seeing taxes and fees tacked onto their phone bill, so who's going to notice another couple of bucks, right? Well, Marketplace's Dan Weisman, for one.
So first, yes, government officials do love to sneak taxes and fees into phone bills, and anywhere they can that isn't an actual tax bill. David Bernouri is a professor at George Washington University and deputy publisher of Tax Analysts.
The bias is towards hiding taxes. That is true at every level of government. If you can, politicians would rather have you pay the tax and not know about it.
And yes, wireless phone bills in particular became a favorite hiding place.
Really, from 2003 till about 2012, we saw sort of a steady upward increase in wireless taxes and fees.
That's Scott Mackey, a consultant to the wireless industry with KSE Partners. He publishes reports on wireless tax rates from state to state, which vary a lot.
Chicago is going to feature prominently in the 2014 report.
He says the new fees there will make the effective tax rates on cell phones the country's highest. But somebody else is likely sneaking charges onto your phone bill, too. Your phone company. Mark David Seidel is a business professor at the University of British Columbia and the co-founder of a site dedicated to making sense of phone bills. So look at the section on your bill called Taxes and Fees.
The fact that it's grouped together and called Taxes and Fees instead of just Taxes is a really high signal that there's other stuff in there that's actually not mandated. It's just a company-specific fee.
Every company charges a different mix, and he says they change all the time. If you really want to know what you're paying and why, he recommends looking for a consumer advocate office in your state. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weisman for Marketplace.
So you decide at some point in your life that you want to be a doctor. You spend who knows how many years and who knows how much money. And then one day, when all's said and done, you discover that maybe medicine's not all it's cracked up to be. Welcome to the life of Dr. Sandeep Jahar, cardiologist and author, who writes about his career in his new book, Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I guess maybe the place to start is, what happened? with your career. You were happy and successful, and it seems sort of that you're not now.
Well, the book is about what I call the midlife crisis of American medicine, and it's told through my first few years as an attending cardiologist at a large teaching hospital in New York. Mm. And what I found was that doctors were tremendously demoralized, and they were behaving in ways that some might consider unethical. There was a lot of unnecessary testing. There was sort of blatant cronyism in calling specialty consults. And patients, too, were very unhappy. The medical system was clearly not responding to their needs. And it was in that sort of environment that I started my medical practice.
And you come from a long line of physicians, we should say.
Yeah, I'm married to a doctor. but my mother is the daughter of a physician from India. And, you know, she always told us that she wanted us to become doctors because she wanted people to stand when we walked into a room.
Huh.
And, you know, she was of the generation that held doctors in a very special, exalted place in society.
Yeah.
And that situation has changed.
Surely it could not have been news to you, though, that patients were increasingly, and this is back in 2004-ish or so, patients were increasingly becoming seen as revenue instead of people, that unnecessary testing was growing, if not already a widespread phenomenon in medicine, that billing was a mess, and that doctors were working harder for arguably less, both in prestige and remuneration.
That was something that we knew about as trainees, but it was hard to appreciate before going into practice how dominant the financial aspects of modern American medicine really are. And what the system has done is forced physicians to behave in ways that they don't want to behave in. No medical student goes to become a doctor, to become a business person. But the system is so dysfunctional today that it has created this business mentality among doctors.
Was there a moment when you knew, when you realized that you weren't practicing medicine the way you wanted to practice medicine?
Well, this is the crux of the book, that like most new physicians, I wanted to practice with the ideals that I had been trained with, and I found that I was struggling financially with student loans and with a family, and I was forced to supplement my hospital salary by moonlighting, and I ended up moonlighting for a profit-driven private practice in Queens that did a lot of unnecessary testing. And so the physician I was working for had this line of patients out the door who were getting stress tests that were of really questionable value. And those first few months doing that, I came to recognize how wasteful it was. Patients were getting all this unnecessary radiation. It was horrible, and it really contributed to a very deep depression, a professional depression.
This is obviously a time of great change in American medical care, and I wonder whether you are hopeful that we collectively will figure it out.
Well, I think we have to. You know, the system is at a critical point. Today, if a politician says we have the best medical system in the world, he doesn't sound patriotic. He just sounds clueless because the system is wonderful if you have a rare disease or if you require very high-tech care. But if you're a run-of-the-mill patient who has a chronic disease that needs to be managed by multiple doctors, the level of communication and coordination in the American system is so weak, so lacking, that that patient care really has suffered. So we have to fix the system.
It's a book called Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician by Dr. Sandeep Jahar. Dr. Jahar, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, an observation, I guess you could say, about the state of journalism here in 2014. The website Gawker has published a spreadsheet prepared by Time Inc. ranking a number of writers and editors at Sports Illustrated on a scale of 1 to 10 on quality of writing, productivity, social media prowess, enthusiasm, and whether the content they create is, quote, beneficial to advertiser relationship, end of quote. A Time spokesperson said today that SI's editorial content is uncompromised. Okay, but still. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow up 175 points, 1%. The NASDAQ added 43 points, just shy of 1%. The S&P 500 up 16 points, 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Josh Wu. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.